I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We have our regular Friday features coming up in Faith Matters. We'll talk about a provision in the new health care law that would require employers, including many religious institutions, to cover contraception in their employee health plans. We'll hear more about why some religious leaders are outraged about this and why the White House says it will not back down. That's in a few minutes. And the Barbershop Guys will be here later on their Super Bowl picks. And we'll also tell you about the NFL's new fashion offerings for the ladies. That's all coming up. But first, we want to spend some time talking about an issue that President Obama highlighted in his State of the Union address last week: the large number of students who drop out of high school. Nationally, out of every four students who start public high school, one doesn't finish on time or at all. That according to the U.S. Department of Education. Yesterday, we talked about the situation nationally and in the nation's capital, which is struggling to keep students in school. We met a young woman who had dropped out but has since gone back. But in some places like Nevada, the numbers are particularly grim. That state has the lowest graduation rate in the country, according to federal figures, just 56%. Now, a multi-million dollar federal grant has encouraged one Nevada school district to use tough love to bring dropouts back to class. School officials are calling it the Reclaim Your Future program. And as part of that effort, school officials in Clark County spent last Saturday knocking on the doors of students who had dropped out, trying to convince them to come back. We wanted to hear more about all this, so we've called on Nettie Alvarez. She is the principal of Western High School, and this week she is profiled in the Las Vegas Sun series on that city's so-called turnaround schools. Also with us is Paul Takahashi. He is an education reporter with the Las Vegas Sun who's been following the district's efforts, and they're both with us. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Nettie Alvarez, I'd like to start with you. Only 43% of the students who started your school in 2006 actually graduated with their class in 2010, according to the district's figures. Why do you think that is?
There's many reasons that, you know, they drop out. There are reasons, poverty, pregnancy, students not being engaged. They don't see a value, no connection. There's not a value there for them. Some of them have lost of credits. In the 9th and 10th grade, they lose their credits. They haven't passed their proficiency exams. Then they don't see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So they think that, you know, there's no reason for them to return. So they drop out.
Paul Takahashi, one of the things I learned from your series is that it has not always been this way. In the 2002-2003 school year, graduation rate in Nevada was 72%. But as we said, most recently was 56%. Two questions. Why does Nevada have the lowest graduation rate in the country, and why has the trend gotten worse?
Well, there are many different factors, as Nettie just said. There are, factors of poverty. Las Vegas, of course, was really wrecked hard by this recession. It has the highest unemployment rate in the country. Recent numbers came out today for the national level, but we're at least 5 percentage points higher. You know, Las Vegas is the foreclosure and bankruptcy rate capital in the nation. And so you've got a lot of different factors here that lead to homelessness among students. That give rise to things such as crime and drugs and alcohol abuse. And a lot of those things, of course, impact family life. Families working two or three jobs just to make ends meet. And so you've got a lot of students here who might be working to help support their families. And so the recession has really hit Las Vegas very hard. Some of those graduation rate numbers, of course, have been inflated over the years as the school districts across the nation look towards a more accurate graduation figure. And so Las Vegas has had a fairly low graduation rate over the years.
So, in fact, the latest figure, there probably isn't as big of a gap as we're seeing. You're saying that part of it is the previous number was probably inflated before, and this is really a more accurate picture, and including
right,
all the numbers that you mentioned. So, Nettie Alvarez, as we mentioned, that you recently, along with a number of other school officials and a lot of volunteers, went door-to-door last Saturday trying to track down students who had dropped out. What were you hoping to accomplish, and do you think you succeeded?
Well, we're trying to reclaim our students, the students that have dropped out, and that's the whole purpose of this initiative. And yes, I believe, you know, once, if it's just one student, it's one more. It's one more that we have at school that we can put them on a program so that they're able to graduate. So I think it's a great initiative that our Superintendent Dwight Jones and Deputy Superintendent Pedro Martinez have implemented. And this past Saturday was the second time around that we've done this. And, you know, the first time was in September, and we were able to claim some. And this time around, we went out not just for the seniors. We were looking at students who were had attendance issues. So we were out knocking on doors and trying to get, you know, speak to the parents. Why isn't your child coming to school? They need to come to school. We want them to graduate. And giving them different alternatives and having a plan of action for them so that they can see, you know, there are different routes that we have here at school. There are different things that are being implemented so that you can be successful. There's credit retrieval classes. There's different programs that Clark County has instituted for our students. And I think it's a very positive thing. This is not something that our school district has ever done. This is the first time that we've done this. It was a very positive thing for me, and to go out and visit with the parents and speak to the parents. And I know, as same with my colleagues who were also out there and the superintendent who was out there visiting homes, it's great to see, you know, their smile on their faces, like, you care. You really want us to come back, and it's, yes, we want you to come back. You know, we need you at school. It's for your future. There's a reason why you need to graduate. And I truly believe that some of our students just, and I'm only speaking for Western, you know, my students at Western, in speaking with them, I have students who have stated to me, I don't know why I need a high school diploma. You know, what's the reason? You know, my parents didn't go to school. They haven't attended. And they're being, you know, they have a job and they're doing okay. That's true for some, not for all. And it's changing a whole mindset in a school like ours that's at risk.
Sure.
And we have a high, Hispanic population.
Let me jump in here. I'm speaking with Nettie Alvarez. She's the principal of Western High School in Las Vegas. We're talking about efforts to get high school dropouts to come back to school. Principal Alvarez, among other school officials and volunteers, went door to door last weekend to try to persuade students who had dropped out to come back to school. Also with us, Paul Takahashi. He's a reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, who's been reporting on efforts like this. You know, on this program yesterday, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about high dropout rates in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. WAMU reporter Kavitha Cardoza talked about some of the challenges she sees in the schools that she's covered. I just want to play a short clip from that conversation.
A lot of times these children have so much going on in their lives, they either check out, so they're distracted, they put their heads down, go to sleep, or sometimes they start arguing with the teacher. So often when they're out of class, the teachers feel, oh, we can concentrate on the students who are here who really want to learn.
What about that, Principal Alvarez? Have you found that to be true, that in fact there's some mixed signals there, that even though the system, you know, of course teachers want to teach, but that it actually can be harder than many people might think to reintegrate students who've had a lot of time out of the classroom? Do you think that's true?
It's very true. It's hard to get students engaged. And, of course, it's a whole mindset that we're changing, especially at Western. And it's having the right people in the right place and everyone, you know, having the common goal. Our goal as educators is to educate our kids. And at Western, you know, we don't allow kids to sleep in class. You're probing kids. You're engaging them in activities. You have to show that school has a value, and that, you know, our big thing is capturing kids' hearts, where kids know that our teachers are caring, that they want them to succeed. Some of our students haven't had that in the past.
Sure. Paul, let me bring you back into the conversation, Paul Takahashi. You also reported on the other initiatives by people outside of the school system in the community to try to wrap their arms around these kids. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, particularly, you can see where a student, perhaps if his parents are both unemployed, and he or she might feel real pressure to help out at home. So what are some of the other initiatives to try to get kids back in school?
Sure. This Reclaim Your Future initiative is a graduation initiative, of course, started by the new superintendent here. And it's a wide range of different activities, and the cornerstone of it being these community door-to-door walks, trying to get kids to, you know, who might have dropped out to come back to school. But there are a whole other, a number of different aspects, the most recent being this program, a mentorship program, to attract about 2,000 mentors to help, you know, about 2,000 students. And so you've got a lot of different community members and volunteers and organizations, nonprofits that are coming in and really trying to help these students. One of them, a partnership between two fairly large nonprofit groups here, bringing in a counselor to help, students at 10 of these schools that are some of the worst performing in the county. So this is a very promising sign. It's a very, with the economy the way it is here, there's a huge emphasis on, you know, diversifying the economy here, and education is really the key to that, a lot of leaders say.
Nettie, Principal Alvarez, we only have a minute left, so I need you to be brief, mm-hmm. if you can. I remember you saying that you at one point almost dropped out. What is it that kept you in the game?
Well, what kept me in the game, of course, my teachers and my parents, who also pushed me to make sure that I went to school, because they didn't have the opportunity from their country to go to school. That wasn't an option. So that was one thing that was always instilled here. And, you know, in America, Nettie, that's why we're here. So you can go to school, you can graduate, because that will be your future. And so it was just everyone pushing and, you know, pulling me forward, that I do believe that that's why I'm here, and that's kind of what I feel that I have to give back to this community is that.
Well, good. Let's check back in later in the year and just see, maybe toward graduation, and see how it all worked out. Nettie Alvarez is the principal of Western High School in Las Vegas. Paul Takahashi is an education reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. He's been reporting on the district's efforts to get dropouts to come back to high school. They were both kind enough to join us from member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
To hear our conversation from yesterday on high school dropouts in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., please visit our website. Go to npr.org. Click on the Programs tab and then tell me more. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You might remember that we were in Detroit earlier this week for a special broadcast from member station WDET. Later in our Back Talk segment, we will give you the latest information on some of the stories we covered there, including the looming state takeover of the city if officials can't get the city's finances under control. That's in just a few minutes. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. And if you've been following the GOP primary so far, then you might have heard a number of Republican presidential contenders talk about what they call the Obama administration's war on religion. Part of this criticism stems from a provision in the new health care law that requires employer-sponsored health care plans to offer contraceptives free of charge and sterilization services, with a few exceptions. The administration recently reaffirmed a position that means that, for the most part, religious universities, hospitals, and charities that serve the general public would be expected to comply. The rule has sparked outrage among a number of conservative religious groups, with several Catholic bishops calling on their parishioners to refuse to comply with the law. This is Bishop David Zubik, leader of the Archdiocese of Pittsburgh, speaking to NPR.
We can't comply, and we won't comply. There's no way we can. It's a matter of conscience.
We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon Lori Goodstein. She is a national religion correspondent for the New York Times, and she's with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Could you just talk a little bit more about what the administration's position is on this?
Well, the administration says that it's been trying to strike a balance between preventive health care services, offering that to everybody, and covering contraception is a big part of that. They say it's a big piece of preventive care. It reduces unwanted pregnancies. It saves money in the long run. And they've also pointed out that it actually might reduce the incidence of abortion. So they say they're trying to balance that with the needs of religious organizations. And the White House has gone out of its way to say, individual churches are not going to be affected by this. If an individual church does not believe in contraception and does not want to offer its employees contraceptive coverage in its insurance plan, it does not have to. It also does not affect an individual, say a Catholic doctor who doesn't want to prescribe birth control. He's not going to be forced to prescribe birth control under this plan. It's for larger institutions that employ a diverse, you know, group of people or serve a diverse group of people.
Now, as we said, a number of religious leaders from different backgrounds have called this an attack on religious freedom. But at the National Prayer Breakfast yesterday, without mentioning this topic specifically, President Obama said his policies are, in fact, guided by his faith. And I'll just play a short clip of his remarks.
Our goal should not be to declare our policies as biblical. It is God who is infallible, not us. Michelle reminds me of this often. So instead, it is our hope that people of goodwill can pursue their values and common ground and the common good as best they know how, with respect for each other.
But, Lori, as we said, a number of groups, including the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, have issued some very strongly worded statements calling this an attack on religious freedom and literally unconscionable. Why do they feel so strongly about this?
Well, the Catholic bishops see this as the government forcing the church to violate their own conscience by having to pay for contraception. So the bishops as a group have been very outspoken on this, with some of them even to the point of saying that the president is saying to hell with you. They are in the forefront of this, but they're not the only religious group that is making an issue of it. Also, the National Association of Evangelicals has issued a statement. But there are many, many other religious groups that do support contraception and have pretty much stayed on the sidelines and stayed quiet because implicitly they support the president's position.
We're speaking with the New York Times religion correspondent Lori Goodstein. We're talking about a controversy between the Obama administration and some religious leaders, including the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, over a provision in the new health care law which would require employer-sponsored health care plans to cover contraceptives and sterilization services. A number of conservative religious groups are saying that they simply cannot abide with this, and they are very angry, calling it an attack on religion. There were hints earlier that the administration might soften on this, that that was the initial rule that was proposed. Does that square with your reporting, or was that just wishful thinking?
Well, I think part of the reason the bishops are so outraged is that they feel that they were given a signal by the administration and directly by President Obama. Archbishop Dolan met with President Obama. They talked about the work that the Catholic Church does, that the Catholic Church is not just parishes, but is also hospitals, is universities, charities, and that all these institutions have a right to express their religious freedom and religious conscience. So Archbishop Dolan thought that he had gotten through to President Obama and thought he had a signal that this decision would go their way. So when it didn't, they felt greatly betrayed by the president.
Is there any talk of a compromise on this question, since the line seemed to be drawn rather firmly and heatedly on both sides at this point?
Well, the compromise was that they gave these organizations a year to comply. So it doesn't really go into effect until August 2013. And they said that was to give these organizations that haven't previously provided this kind of insurance coverage time to transition. But that's as far as they've gone with a compromise. They are not saying that they're going to back off from this. Now, there are efforts on Capitol Hill to pass legislation that will force the administration to back off. But I will tell you that John Boehner was going around saying that this is unconstitutional. Now, what that doesn't square with is that up until now, 28 states already had laws that required organizations, even religious organizations, to cover contraception in their insurance plans. So for 28 states, this is not a change. And there wasn't a big hue and cry about this before.
Here is a question I have, and I'm interested in your take on this. Is the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has expressed itself very strongly on this point. But I'm wondering if, in your reporting, do you find that Catholic lay people share their point of view on this?
Well, lay people do get worked up if they are told that their religious liberty is being violated and that the government is trying to infringe on the rights of Catholics and the Catholic Church. But they might not get as worked up if they were clear that the whole issue is about contraception. Studies show that something like 98% of Catholic women have used contraception. There is no single Catholic voting bloc, And the bishops certainly don't command all Catholics and lead them in the direction that they're going to vote. The Catholic electorate is just as split as the general electorate. Now, there's a divide in the Catholic Church between the liberal, kind of social justice, Vatican II Catholics, and the more conservative Catholics who are also, by and large, those who attend church more faithfully. The bishops, though, in recent years have become more politically conservative. And so rather than emphasizing issues that the bishops used to emphasize, say economic injustice or war, they have moved to put in the forefront more of these sexuality issues like homosexuality, abortion, contraception. And that's what we're seeing here.
Lori Goodstein is the national religion correspondent for the New York Times, and she was kind enough to join us from their studios there. Lori Goodstein, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Switching gears now, we are turning to America's secular religion, football. It's Super Bowl Sunday coming up, and as you stock up on necessary supplies, your chili, your wings, your popcorn, your chips, finally, fashionistas have something to look forward to as well. Now they can stock up on their favorite team gear. Women make up 44% of the NFL's fan base, and recently the NFL launched the Fit for You campaign to better highlight new and improved women's apparel lines. Here to talk more with us about fashion and the Fit for You campaign is Rhiannon Madden. She is the director of apparel for the NFL. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So director of apparel means what?
That means I actually handle all of the apparel outside of the on-field. So any of the lifestyle apparel you see, whether you shop at Kohl's, Target, Old Navy, all of that stuff, I would have collaborated with our licensees on.
So off the field. I'm tempted to say the on-field outfits, but that wouldn't be the right. That's not what that's called.
The on-field uniforms.
Uniforms,
handled,
of course.
Yes, yeah. That's handled within my group as well, but I don't work as closely with
that. But you do that. So when did this campaign start? Or I guess the question is really, how did you figure out that women would like their own stuff?
Well, we've actually been offering product for women for the past 10 years, but we hadn't communicated that well enough for people to know, so women didn't know where to buy it or that we even had it. So we realized, yeah, we have, as you said, 44% of our fan base is female. That's 80 million women. These are all individuals. They don't engage with the sport in the same way. So we looked at them and said, what can we do to be better for our fans? So we knew they shopped at all different places, wore different things, whether it was maternity, plus size, fitness products. We wanted to make sure that we had something for everyone.
So what's different about the women's apparel now? I think a lot of women, like me, who play sports or like sports, the only way you knew that something was for you was that it was pink.
Right? Yeah, we call that shrinking and pink it. And listen, that some people that still appeals to. But we have a lot more women that want to be what we call loud and proud. That's our avid fan. Or we have women that want to be a little more casual about it and show it in a more subtle way.
Okay, but what about evening wear? Is there any NFL evening wear?
We do have some. We have very glitzy jewelry, which I'm actually wearing a piece of it right now. We have amazing.
Really? Tell me. Yeah. Describe.
I have on, it's a sterling silver necklace. I happen to be a Patriots fan. I love all the teams, but I happen to be a Patriots fan.
This interview's over. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Never mind. Okay. I'll try to pull it together. Okay.
It's got a really beautiful crystal bead. And we have a lot of jewelry like this. We have stackable rings, bangles, all types of stuff. So that to dazzle up your evening wear. We also have evening bags, like really cool clutches, really nice stuff.
Forgive me. Do regular people actually buy that stuff? Glam, blingy?
Yeah, you know what? I was surprised by it, too, because we did take a chance, and we have a really high-end handbag line. We have, footwear that's a lot more high-end, and the consumers are out there, and they've responded, and they rock it. They look just as good and as the women of the NFL family, so absolutely.
Fashion these days often comes, how can I put it, bottom up as opposed to top down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much about the designers telling people what they should wear as consumers somehow or another indicating what they want to wear in the market responding. So how would you describe this line? Do you think it's bottom up or top down?
I think it's a collaboration, really, because I think we do follow because we want to see what they're interested in and we want to create wearing occasions for our products. So it's a bit of both, I would have to say.
So what are you going to be rocking on Sunday? for the big game.
I'm actually rocking. This is crazy. I'm wearing a full sequined Patriots jersey, and I'm not actually the type of girl that would wear sequins normally, but I just had to. It's just so off the charts, and I know it's going to get a lot of attention and for my Patriots. So that's what I will be rocking.
Okay, well, we won't be looking for you, but you know, I would say good luck, but I wouldn't mean it. So but before I let you go, you know, I have to ask: are you related to the Madden?
I am not, but I get asked that. Actually, that's the third time I've been asked that today, without fail. I've worked for the NFL for actually almost 11 years, and I get asked every single day. No relation, though.
No relation. Not a bad name to have, though.
No, it's not. I probably should just go with it sometime.
All right. Well, what can we look forward to in the future? Are you working on something super secret? You can give us just a little hint about something that might be coming down the pike.
Well, for the Fashionista, we definitely have a lot coming out. We're going to be collaborating with some designers. We've been speaking to quite a few. So that's one thing. And then we also will have a real focus on fitness. A lot to look forward to.
Okay. Something to look forward to next year when the Giants are hoisting the Lombardi Trophy. Oh, sorry. Did I just say Rhiannon Madden is the director of apparel for the NFL, and she was kind enough to join us from member station WFYI in Indianapolis, which is hosting Super Bowl 46, which will be played on Sunday. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Back Talk. That's where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere. Editor Ahmad Omar is here with us once again. We'll get to him in just a minute. But before we do, I just want to start with a correction. In our barbershop segment last week, I said that a quote about Adam Levine, who was a former assistant White House secretary, came from The New Yorker magazine. The quote actually came from The New York Observer in a column written by Joe Hagan. So now that we've clarified that, Ahmad, what do you have for us?
Well, Michelle, you're still shaking off the jet lag from that one-hour trip to Detroit. We aired the program from WDET in Detroit on Tuesday. That's my hometown, so we've got a Detroit-centric back talk today. Let's start with this from Noah Stevens. He wrote in and had this to say.
Hey, Michelle. Thanks for giving the rest of the nation a look at what's great about Detroit. Come back soon.
You know I will, Noah. We had a great time in Detroit, and thanks to all of our great hosts out there, and thanks to those who wrote in. What else do you have for us?
Well, Michelle, Noah's a photographer, so Noah, you can check out some pictures listeners sent in from Detroit on our blog. Just go to npr.org/tellmemore and click on that blog link.
And I also think we have a news update from Detroit also. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. You interviewed Detroit Mayor Dave Bing while you were out there. The city's trying to slash its budget to avoid a state takeover that could strip the mayor of a lot of his powers and could cancel a lot of union deals. Here's a quick clip of your conversation with Mayor Bing.
I had a financial crisis day one when I walked into the office. And so trying to let people know how dire the situation is, because most people look back and say, you know, I remember the good old times. Well, the good old times are the good old times. They're not coming back. We've got to do something altogether different.
Well, on Thursday, city officials announced that they'd reached a tentative deal with about half of the public unions there to rework some of those contracts and cut the budget. But it's not clear if that will actually prevent a state takeover because the financial crisis is so deep there in Detroit.
We will definitely keep following that story. What else do you have?
All right, quick fun fact for you. In Detroit, you've got to go south to cross the border into Canada. Obviously, for most people, south of the border means Mexico. Kristen Mello from Newberry Park, California, was reminded of that country when she heard a segment with Oscar-nominated actor Demian Bichir. He talked about some of his favorite songs and mentioned Ojalá by Silvio Rodriguez, and that brought back some memories.
Kristen wrote that the song, quote, took me instantly back to the days when I was living in Mexico City and in love with a wonderful musician. He sang me that song and wrote the lyrics down for me once he knew how much I loved it as a courting gesture. So this morning I sat at my computer crying at the beauty of the memory. Thank you.
You're welcome, Kristen. And get your Kleenex out because we're going to play it for you one more time.
Ojalá que las hojas no te toquen el cuerpo cuando caigan. Para que no las puedas convertir en cristal.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522 or visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. You can also find us on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. And thank you, Ahmad.
Thank you.
One last bonus letter. Barbara Hoffman from Mill Rift, Pennsylvania writes in, I just love the barbershop guys. I even like it when they talk sports. Well, Barbara, you'll want to stay tuned because just ahead, the guys will be making their Super Bowl picks, even though some of them had the Detroit Lions winning it all a few weeks ago. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in their chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance journalist Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre, and new to the shop, National Review contributor Neil Minkoff. Actually, fellas, don't be intimidated. He's actually Dr. Minkoff. He's trained as a primary care physician. So if you have any aches and pains you want to discuss with him, I'm sure he'll be happy to help you out.
I haven't touched a patient in well over a decade.
Well, you can't touch them either. It's all like telemedicine. Anyway, take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks for that, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
Yo, what's
good?
Up?
Dr. Neil, good to have you in, man.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be part of the proceedings.
Alrighty then. Let's get things started with the Republican presidential candidate who seemed to have a very poor choice of words when it comes to the very poor. Now, you guys know who I'm talking about former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Michelle, we got some tapes of the offending comments, yeah?
Yeah, and I think it's good so people can hear for themselves exactly what he said. He spoke to CNN the morning after he won the Florida primary. He was speaking with CNN's Soledad O'Brien in the morning show. Here it is.
I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90, 95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
Thanks for that, Michelle. Personally, I don't know why he's catching all this flack, but he seems to be still catching a lot of flack for this comment. Arsalan Iftikhar.
Yes, sir.
A-Train, you're up first, man.
Well, this is not the first time that, Governor Romney has stuck his foot in his mouth during the campaign. We all remember the famous $10,000 bet that he extended to Governor Rick Perry and the fact that he said that he, quotes, like firing people. And now he's saying that he's, quote, not concerned about the very poor, but he's concerned about the 90 to 95% of Americans. What he doesn't know is that according to the 2010 census, 15% of the American public currently lives in poverty. 58% of Americans have at least spent 1 year in poverty during their lifetime. It seems, with these statements, that he's really only pandering to the Carter Peuterschmidts and the Montgomery Burnses of the world. Excellent.
Oh, wait a second. That's not fair, A-Train. A-Train, that's not fair.
I know Carter Peuterschmidt. He's a very nice man.
He clarified his comments. What he meant to say was that, he wanted to speak to the wide swath of middle-class America. And that's basically what he's been saying. That's the same tune he's been whistling on his whole way down the trail. He was trying to shorthand his message, and he failed. I mean, we can't all be as well scripted as Obama, man. But thank you so much for checking in, Neil, of the National Review. This is your former governor, man. Come on, check in.
Yeah, I got to check in because I'm probably the only person here who's voted for more than once. But, the problem Mitt has, I think, is that he keeps talking boardroom speak or equity language instead of speaking political. And this is a real problem for him. That's the same problem as when he said corporations are people, or he told Santorum that some of the things in the mandate weren't worth getting angry about. If he had just said something like, we have great safety nets like Medicaid and food stamps. We still have to take care of the poor, but we can't take care of the poor unless the middle class gets shored up. It would have been fine. He would have said it in a way that was considered acceptable. He's speaking, economics shorthand, and it's just not translating well.
he's just not good off script. This guy needs to become a Muppet so somebody can tell you know so somebody can feed him lines. Pablo, Mr. Torre, I mean, you know, he said he's not down with the very rich either, but he got a very rich endorsement from none other than Donald Trump. I don't know that we care, do we?
Well, I was like, oh, thank God, now they have something to take their minds off of the fact that Mitt Romney doesn't care about very poor people by getting endorsed by the guy who fires people on television for fun. No, I mean, Donald Trump is a character. I don't think anybody takes him seriously. Mitt Romney's problem is the rhetorical problem. I mean, it's just the rhetorical equivalence between mentioning on one hand the very poor and one hand the very rich and saying they're both fine. I mean, was anybody even going to consider the fact that Mitt Romney was going to spend his time helping very poor people? Was that like his messaging problem on the campaign trail? I don't think it was. So the fact that he's just volunteering this stuff, once again, and Neil put it very well, in a way that can be so at best misconstrued and at worst reveal the sort of callous indifference towards people who he's very much unlike is troubling, not only as a person on the campaign trail, but also as a person who's expected to talk to the American public as the leader of the free world, as he may very well be doing it here.
Let me just throw one more thing in there. He says that he misspoke. I mean, there were days, for days he defended his comments, and then he, at the end of the day, said he misspoke. But you know what they say, a gaffe in Washington is when a politician says what he really thinks.
Right,
so there's
right.
that. Let me just throw one thing out here, just which may be of interest. And I do want to mention that the unemployment rate has been dropping again. It dipped to 8.3% in January from 8.5% the month before. But roughly a quarter of Republican voters have annual family incomes under $30,000 a year. And most of those voters surveyed by the Pew Research Center, which provided these numbers, say that the government does not do enough for poor people in this country. So I'm fascinated by this figure. I think that will probably be a surprise to many people who may assume that Republicans represent the 1%, so to speak. And so, Neil, just before we move on, Dr. Neil, I wanted to ask you if, you know, a lot of people say, you know, Obama doesn't talk enough about the poor. But I did want to ask you if you feel that do Republicans have a message, a credible message around the poor? Have you heard one?
Well, I mean, to me, it seems as if one of the things, this goes back to the what's the matter with Kansas argument, which is what percent of those, how many of those 25% of the Republican voters who are not making lots of money are responding to the social message and are more social conservatives. And while on the one hand they feel government should be doing more to help the poor, on the other hand they're much more concerned about gay marriage or abortion or what have you on the social issues. So I'm not sure that you can take those two things apart when you're looking at a voting record.
Yeah, interesting. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and we're having our weekly visit to the barber shop, getting ready for the weekend. We're joined by freelance journalist Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, Dr. Neil Minkoff. He's a contributor to the National Review, and Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, fellas, I got three words for you. Super Bowl Sunday!
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's up this weekend. A-Train, Arsalan Iftikhar, you know, I'm going to give you the floor since you've always, well, at least to date, well, recently, you correctly picked the team. So who's going to walk away with the ring, man?
A fact which he does not fail to remind us of every
Let me brush I'm going to brush my shoulders off before I give this prediction. But I think that this Super Bowl is going to revolve around three syllables, Gronkowski. I think, you know, New England Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski is really going to, you know, be the X factor in this game. And, you know, as somebody who picked the Giants-Patriots Super Bowl, being an AFC East fan, if Eli Manning is a Jedi warrior, then Tom Brady is Obi-Wan Kenobi. Patriots 24, Giants 20.
Oh, no.
I have issue with Arsalan's characterization of Tom Brady as a Jedi. It's very clear that
he's
Tom Brady...
Obi-Wan, dog.
As Obi-Wan. It's very clear that Tom Brady is, at very least, Darth Vader. I mean, the guy is the most hateable athlete
that's
in
Belichick.
The sports universe. Well, Bill Belichick is the emperor. I think Tom Brady is Darth Vader.
Why is he the most hateable? Can you help me out with that?
Yeah, this is why. It's pure envy, right? I mean, he's the guy who basically looks like a male model, is absurdly successful and wealthy, dates Gisele Bündchen, lives in this... Have you seen the mansion that he's building or just built? It's a $20 million
mansion. And won a few Super Bowls on the way there.
And he has Super Bowls.
A couple of years ago.
Oh, God.
A couple years ago, I had the opportunity to bring my son to meet Tom Brady, and I can assure you there is no way to feel good about yourself as a man standing next to Tom Brady.
He's just exactly.
perfect looking and rich and chiseled and has this gorgeous wife, and I walked in. It's the worst I've ever felt about myself.
But you wrote this piece for the National
said the
Review.
Same thing about me.
Yeah, that's true. You're right, Jimmy. When was that? I'm sorry, I forgot. But you wrote this piece for the National Review talking about the possibility of Brady actually falling flat on his face this Sunday. What's up with that?
Well, I mean, it's not so much this Sunday, although I'm worried about it, as it has been the last few playoff games. I mean, my theory is that, you know, great athletes react without thinking. And that's, you know, the zone. And Bird talks about the game slowing down for him. And Ocho Cinco's talking this season about the game being too fast for him, so he can't catch anything. And that I think that what's happened is Brady is starting to think about being the greatest of all time and winning the fourth ring and all of the things that means to his legacy. And he stopped reacting and he started thinking. And that rather than it just being defensive lines getting after him, I think that he's actually been slow to release the ball because he's not just reacting. He's sitting there and looking. Where's Welker? Where's Branch? Where's Gronk? And he's thinking too much.
Yeah, where's Waldo? To me, I don't disagree with Neil at all, but to me it seems like quibbling with Tom Brady's performance in recent years is kind of like my friends at Goldman Sachs crying about their bonuses this year. I mean, the guy is still unbelievable, and he's still throwing up top five numbers in basically every passing category. I see this game. I mean, I'm in New York, and when this happened in 2008, people literally sprung forward from their doors and into the streets and were rioting because the Giants had beat the Patriots. And if there's anything the NFL needs, it's a Red Sox-Yankees football version. I think the Giants are going to do the exact same thing again, 17-14 Giants.
Thank you.
So I'm going to push back on that bit and say that, sorry.
Go ahead, Neil. Dr. Neil, go ahead.
No, it's just that I was going to push back and say that Brady's numbers don't bear that out. His last few playoff games, except for the one against the Broncos, which is very aberrational, he's had quarterback ratings of 49.1 and 57.5 when his career is something like a 96. So he's saying that Brady's not doing well isn't quibbling anymore. It's kind of a more of what have you done for me lately? It's been
right,
5 years.
Right, and this year, though, regular season, 39 touchdown passes, fourth most in the league, second most yards. I mean, obviously the playoffs are where the money is made, but he's been a very good quarterback this year, too.
So, Neil, hold on. Before we move on, I have to ask Jimmy who his pick is. So you're with the Patriots, but is that your head or your heart?
Well, actually...
Neil. Then I'm going to need you, Jimmy. I was asking Dr. Neil.
It's my heart. My son was 5 when he started paying attention to football in 2007. He had never seen the Patriots win, and he cried for 2 hours after the Super Bowl.
Aww.
It's my heart. I don't want to watch him go through that again.
Now he's put us in a terrible quandary. but not really, because I'm from New York. Sorry.
There you go.
Jimmy, who are you with? What are you watching?
I'm watching Madden with the boy, and I think this is probably going to be the only way I'm going to get the Browns in the Super Bowl in my lifetime. So I think that's probably the way I'm going to go. I just might. And Madonna's, you know, doing the halftime show. I think I'm going to have to tune out of the Super Bowl this year. Sorry. Yeah, I don't want to see that spectacle.
What a hater.
Cry into your Browns jersey, Jimmy. There you go.
Right.
A hater. Well, this is a sad note. Kind of a sad note that we want to end on, but we want to talk about, well, I don't know if it's sad. We want to mark the legacy of Don Cornelius, the creator of the television show Soul Train. He was found dead of an apparent suicide earlier this week. He was 75 years old. But, Jimmy, I think we'd like to focus on the legacy here. So what are your memories?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because my mom didn't really let me watch a Soul Train that much because, you know, the women were really scantily clad. And in my market, you know, it came on after dark. So, I mean, it was kind of like BET Uncut, lightweight. But, of course, I snuck and watched it. And I had friends also that traveled to get on the show. And, you know, when they got back, you know, I mean, having been on Soul Train, that was like their social Jerry curl. I mean, it changed how you looked at them, and it gave them entree into a whole new... Like every social circle imaginable, you know. But I got to say this. I mean, Soul Train, you know, after Don retired, it was virtually unwatchable. I mean, he was the soul of the Soul Train, and he'll be missed.
Well, Pablo, you had something?
Yeah, just to jump in real quick. This was obviously, you know, before my time a little bit, but I was watching all these YouTube videos last night, and they're great. And the thing that somebody wrote in an obituary, that this was like the forerunner for So You Think You Can Dance and America's Best Dance Crew, that kind of thought strikes me as so off. I mean, this show was something where you appreciated music for music's sake and dancing as something that you could hope to emulate, possibly. I don't think anybody watches those shows to see what's cool today. I wonder what the next show is that'll be the real homage to Soul Train.
Well, it kind of was a real reality show of its time, because I can tell you that since it is not before my time, since you pointed it out, Pablo, thank you so much. You know, we used to run to get through our chores on Saturday morning so that we could watch Soul Train, because if we hadn't done all of our chores, couldn't watch it. So that was how we practiced our dance moves, is that's how we learned them, is by watching Soul Train. I mean, that's what we do. Arsalan, you follow this.
Well, yeah, and you know, as somebody who grew up in Chicago, you know, Don Cornelius was a Chicago institution. You know, before it went to national syndication from 1971 to 2006, it was actually, Soul Train was a local show on WCIU-TV in Chicago. And, you know, like you said, Don Cornelius epitomized cool. You know, it was sort of, for those of us, people of color, growing up in Chicago in the 80s, like some of us who couldn't really tie into the Dick Clark American Bandstand zeitgeist, Soul Train was it for us. And so, you know, he truly epitomized cool and, you know, the voice of a generation.
But it kind of normalized the urban scene.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It's like the kinds of clothes. I mean, I don't know about you. I was not allowed to wear those clothes. I mean, I was not aware of like those pants and those platform shoes and all that other thing. But I did have a big fro, which if any of you pay me a very large sum of money, I'll let you see pictures of.
Oh, man.
And,
I got five, on it.
Dr. Neil, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, so I had a different take on it, having been a primary care doctor and been involved and just spending part of this week talking about end-of-life issues. I mean, from everything that I've read or seen, it seemed as if this man had really been suffering with a lot of chronic pain and a lot of chronic disability. And I think that's a big issue, not to be overly serious here, but, you know, this is one of the big issues in healthcare, is that we aren't really good as either a healthcare system or a society with figuring out how to take care of people with chronic pain and chronic disability. And, you know, this seemed like one of those tragic reminders of the fact that we need to do better here.
That's an important thought. So thank you for that. So, you know, we have to go out on the theme, but can I get one of the wishing you? Can I get one of those? Can I wishing you? Come on, Arsalan, help me.
Love, peace, and soul.
Oh, you can do better than that. Thank you.
I can't do the falsetto, yo.
Train!
Thank you. Here we go.
No problem.
Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Pablo Torre is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant with Fountainhead Healthcare. Dr. Neil Minkoff, he's also a contributor to the National Review. He joined us from Boston. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of themuslimguide.com, and author of Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era. He was here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Love, peace, and soul.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.